Hello.
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 Good evening.
I'm sure Dave will be along very shortly.
I would bet on it.
Well, I wouldn't bet against it.
That's a good thing. I'd never bet against Dave.
Never, ever.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave. We're going to have some discussion time at the beginning and the end. If you'll manage the background noise, perhaps even stay on mute. Until you're ready to talk. Welcome. I really look forward to doing this series with you. I see some familiar faces and some new buddies to be, and the team from the group who I've done training with. So welcome. I look forward to engaging in this specific focus with you. You'll see at the link that you got when you registered in the link that I've sent to others of you, you'll see the download for the outline. There's a fairly annotated outline and a workbook that corresponds with each of the four seminars, and then a port for the playback of each of the recordings. So that will be there. The playback will be up within about 24 hours. So you probably saw my email asking you if you would think about what is the question you have about this topic that seems the greatest challenge or interest to you, you'd like us to address. And then if you walked away from this series 4 weeks from now saying it's one of the best, most useful series you've had, what would you walk away with? And you probably saw those are obviously the two questions that we each ask our clients at the beginning of the session, but it creates a map, and it looks to be something that we can then focus with a map to look at where we are, where we want to go, how to measure progress along the way, and we can tell what's a detour and what's a distraction, because that's the benefit of having a map, and the benefit of focus is all the stuff you ignore to attend to what's really important. When you focus on where you're going with a map, there's a whole world of stuff that you ignore. So that's what we're going to be doing, and looking at the aspects of your relationship with money and understanding your money story. So do any of you want to add anything, those of you who may not have seen the email in time, do you want to add anything to the hopper for discussion about either or both of those two questions? I appreciate the ones of you who have sent in responses, and we've got our work cut out for us because of the questions already asked and the destination hoped for. So we're going to be, I think we're going to have a great deal of fun and offer something that's some different ways of thinking about things, from coaching itself to a money story and how to further your and your client's money story. Anything else you want to add at this point? Well, let me respond just in a beginning way to some of the answers to the questions that I heard. Then we'll get into what we're supposed to be talking about, and I'll start lecture portion where you don't have to worry about background noise, but I wanted to preserve a little bit of time at the beginning for discussion. When we talk about money story, and I'll go into that in a minute, to look at the idea of co-creating a new story with a client or revising a story, remember the client doesn't think of his or her experience as a story. It's just the way things are. Story is our metaphor, our way to think about things and look at putting together both how we perceive and process and understand things. So in one sense, story construction is the job description of the brain. Understanding the story is the job description of the mentor coach. The co-creation of a new system is the job of the collaborative alliance of coach and client. And what you'll see as we develop in the later seminars, the roadmap system, it's simply a way to deconstruct for us as coaches to understand someone's story and then to look at ways that we can engage them to revise or create a new one. And a principle here is we don't have to explore anyone's unconscious. Every algorithm will be revealed in present thought and feeling and behavior. Everything is going to be created there in the relationship with you. And remember, an algorithm is simply a finite series of steps used to solve a problem or enhance a performance. So it's simply a way of understanding someone's story to look at what needs to change from the client's perspective and how to develop that. So those are simply ways that we'll look at developing an understanding, and it's simply one way of understanding as we proceed. So the roadmap system, the seven steps that we'll be talking about, is really a kind of a macro system, a performance macro system to deconstruct and understand a money story. And it's the same process. You could substitute any story, a performance story, a wellness story, a career story. This is simply a way to go about it. We'll be focusing on money, but remember, you can substitute any number of possibilities. Roadmap is an acronym for the seven steps of a scientific and systematic way to deconstruct and understand personally created stories and to strategically create new behavior. So this is a way to go about this in developing a system. And many of you have heard from me repeatedly. If you want to change a habit or behavior or create a new habit or new behavior, focus on the system, not just the goal. Everybody has the same goal. That's abstract and that's down the pike. It's useful to know what your goal is, but to focus on the system, that's what we do in coaching. That's what we're specialists of in coaching. So the roadmap system then becomes a blueprint of story construction to understand and address the mind and brain creation of thoughts, feelings, behaviors, organized into a money story. So any thoughts or questions or add-ons here before we move into the lecture mode? Anybody want to add or ask anything at the beginning? Okay, we'll move. I'll reserve a bit of time at the end for discussion. And I hope if you have anything you want to clarify or ask or add, you'll jot it down, and we'll come back. Okay, in our first seminar, we're going to talk about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. And the remaining three seminars, we're going to look at the principles and practice of systematically changing that story. So This is information from the mind, brain, and performance sciences, from psychology, neuroeconomics, behavioral economics, applied to strategic coaching. And that's exactly what I have in mind to help you in your work with your clients, maybe even first understanding your own story. As you go through the outline and look at the workbook and the workbook tools and exercises, I would suggest doing them yourself so that you can better understand your own story, maybe even see if there are ones that you may want to use with clients. The seven steps are really a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story and a systematic way of constructing a new and revised one. So this is basically, as we go through these seminars and you do the exercises yourself, you're going to be in the best position to coach it. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So put it into action. In fact, very recent research from University of Waterloo, the very simplest study that illustrates the importance of putting something in an output channel. Two groups read the same passage in a book, large groups, and they were divided, you know, in all good research ways. One group read it out loud, another group read it to themselves. They all took a test afterward. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They put it in an output channel. It completed the circuitry in the brain. So let's talk first about your relationship with money. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, and is remarkably simple yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages, and it's complicated for three reasons. Some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, and even unconscious. This story is the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You may get 10 years out of a car, maybe even 50 with a spouse, but this story, you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke with a very well-known international publisher, when we were talking about this some time ago, he said something so simple. He said, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." And of course I said, "Well, that's exactly why you need to publish my book." You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times you may have used this story to regulate your moods, increase your self-esteem or adjust it somehow, influence others, or even soothe emotional pains. And how you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients and your employees. What they see in your behavior and hear it or even sense as your beliefs may be what they incorporated as their own. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all people of the world. It speaks to you. You speak with it. Of course, it's your money story. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So let's consider two questions here. what's your money story? And what ideally would you like your money story to be? So first let's look at what a money story is. Your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, your net worth. It's your relationship with money, the plot and the storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with it, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. And it can be a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you're capable of. And it may be about what would happen if you had more or less. So let's consider some of this. First, we speak with money. We do it in one way, in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, or what we fear and lack, or what we covet, crave, chase, or follow. We use money at times to show how much we care or how little. We use it to measure success or to try to buy happiness. We use it to bolster self-esteem, to regulate moods, to influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also use it as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it. And we make it bigger than it is because it's our Rorschach. We project our own meaning and attributions to money itself. We use money as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Here's the essence of a self-statement. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. And the story tells most about the teller. That's what we're going to do with the roadmap system, is learn how to deconstruct a story so that we can be more effective in working with clients. So here are some self-statements that people make with money: a proclamation of freedom, currency of caring, promissory note for happiness, embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, a license for opportunity, or an instrument of control. You see a new car and want it, but what you're really doing is playing out an aspect of your money story, because just below consciousness, we may be adding a new plot line that says, well, this car is going to show what I'm worth. This is going to make people respect me. This is going to validate me. An obvious example is the self-statement of spending money. Kind of a goofy example, but still. Conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW convertible and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW convertible in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement. I would never buy a convertible. Now, without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. In self-talk, think about whether it's conscious or not, the self-talk, the messages you tell yourself about money, about what you're worth, about what you charge. Examples of these internal beliefs, and these can be themes of a shadow story. Some may be conscious, some not. People who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money will buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. I don't think I was really cut out to have significant wealth. Here's an external dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. People don't talk about it. There's some kind of taboo. The very first book I ever did as a psychoanalyst was a book with the title The Last Taboo, about money and its meanings in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. That was in the middle 80s. In the dark ages. Think of how social conventions create unusual pairings on what it's okay to talk about and not. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economics, but not personal income, definitely not debt. Ask the host, when things clear and you can do these things again, ask the host of your dinner party, how much money do you make? You will not see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? You may not see dessert. Some time ago, an agent at a writer's conference that I was attending discussed working with her authors over the years. She talked about, this was a very well-known, internationally recognized agent who had a lot of experience and bestsellers behind her. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. Someone in the audience, after a good period of time, finally said, would you talk about how much money's involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? She had discussed everything except that. She kind of looked shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt that you don't talk about money. Of course, this was her business, by the way. And while looking as if she were trying to compose herself, an older gentleman in the back row said, well, I thought once you finished the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion useful to her audience interested in writing books for a living. I had the same experience a good deal later with an ICF group meeting where fees were discussed, and somebody said, let's talk about the amount of fees. That's not really something we can legally do. And nobody discussed it. It was shut down immediately. Consider an internal dialogue. While we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, though, is often silent or automatic, but it has many dialects. For example, it was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned, this tells you how long ago this was, at age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. When school started again, I saw my classmates enjoying a Coke and candy after lunch, and I joined them. And my treats were gone very quickly. And I thought about what it took to earn that, what that money cost. And I said, was that candy worth half a roll of cotton? This really tells you how long ago. And then, will I get enough from a soft drink to pay one whole roll of cotton shopping? My answer after that was no to both questions. I did a blog later and incorporated this as a discussion in a book about the cost of money. We often think about, you know, how to apportion, how to use money, but we may forget how much money costs. Some other examples. At an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, I'll give you what I never had as a child. Or the preamble to spending may be to rationalize, well, this seems like a lot of money to spend on a big HD plasma screen TV, but if I spread it out over the next 8 years, it amortizes to only 27 cents a day. Rationalize spending. And then my wife said, Dave, if you want the TV, just go ahead and buy it. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. gifted money spent without a whole lot of debate, salary or professional fee after serious contemplative choice. Savings or retirement is relinquished only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias because money is treated differently based on the framework, on the context. And George Costanza said, "This is found money. I got to blow it on a horse." From a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy stated, "The high from shopping is still more powerful than the low from bankruptcy." Or a final example, the parent who says, "I spend so much time at work when I'm off, I want to buy my child something to make up for it." A justification bias. A compromise can occur when two money stories are written simultaneously. The surface story, and remember that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So we're only aware of a small tip of the iceberg of what's conscious. So the surface story coming from that conscious component, I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. The shadow story from that operating system, from the beliefs and assumptions, and remember, beliefs are anatomical realities in our brain that may have been laid down and developed over time from earliest childhood in terms of what we observed and took in from the model of parents and others. The shadow story may be, you know, I don't think I've got what it takes. Or what if I really try my best and then fail? I'd be embarrassed. Here's another example of a dual story of conflict, a surface and a shadow story that go in the opposite direction. This is what we do in coaching. Look at how all of this is present moment, the choice architecture of the present moment. It doesn't have to do with deep history or origins or the kinds of emotion. Listen to the surface story and the shadow story here, and when they go in opposite directions, somebody's stuck, so it may be helpful to really illuminate both here and now as they're being constructed simultaneously, just in opposite direction. The surface story, I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story says, you know, I can't have total authority because my partner acts like I'm taking it away, or my colleague. Now, here's another perspective. Money speaks to us. A study was done in which volunteers had their brain scanned using fMRI scans as they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the wines. They then rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price. They liked the most expensive one the best, and on down, the least expensive one as last. And their brains corresponded. The areas of the brain that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the more expensive wine, and sequentially down. Their brains responded to the stories, not the wines. The volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. You know, as a sidebar here, I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, correspond with some researchers, a couple of neuroeconomics, but I have never found a study like this to volunteer for. Actually, money sometimes communicates to us below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, even drug. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Here's a money quiz I'd like to do with you. I did this with some different groups, and I'll tell you the outcome, but I'd like to just do the study right now. Put down on your page number 1, 2, and 3. Number 1, give an immediate single answer to these questions. And remember, nobody's watching. My current annual income. put down a figure. In order to ensure happiness and contentment financially, no more money problems and worries, my annual income would need to be what? Put down that figure. And one word, what does money mean to me? Write that word down. So, I've given this quiz to many hundreds of people over the years. For more than 90% of those who I would give them this quiz after a live presentation, often for executives, professionals, people who make some decent money, their answers to the first and second questions indicate that they believe their annual income would need to be about twice the level for them to be happy and free from money worries. Over 90% of the people. So someone who made $50,000 believed that it would take roughly $100,000 to be financially content. For somebody who made $500,000, five times that initial example, they believe the figure would need to be about $1 million. And in follow-up, there was a trailing double. Somebody who made $100,000 thought it would take somewhere around $200,000. When they got to $200,000, they then thought it would take close to $400,000. So, this raises the question of what's enough? There's no end point to wanting more. There's no limit to what you don't have. When you focus on more, on what you don't have, you ensure dissatisfaction. So, think about when you hear goals from your client. More is not a goal. Perfect is not a goal. That will ensure happiness because you can never get to more. You can never get to perfect. So that's why we look for specific, tangible goals that are measurable. Even when you change the numbers, the story remains the same. The story in this case is, I need about twice as much to be really happy. They keep hope alive that it's somewhere there in the future, and maybe it has a number. This is how one of the initial ways that I got interested in the whole psychology of money was as a practicing psychoanalyst. And the executives, the professionals who I saw, some of them came to me when they actually got honest enough or were one step away from recognizing that more would never be enough and they needed to figure out why they weren't happy. Their initial goal may be, you know, to make $1 million a year, to have a retirement account funded for $5 million, or to have a ranch, or to have a whatever. When they reached each of these goals, they were not happy. So they realized something else is going on, or they wanted to ask the question, what's going on? And then that's where we crossed paths, and I got to study and collaborate with them. So let's look at your answer to that last question. What money means to you? That's your money equation. Money can make any statement. The more common ones, worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs show up as symbolic wants. That's when it gets a dollar figure. And a desire is not quieted by its satisfaction. And desires, as marketers know, can actually be created by fulfilling them. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money, as I mentioned, becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when we imbue that design with meaning, the interpretations are going to be as wishful and varied as each person's fantasies. People may think their money is a reflection, for example, of their self-worth or even their morals. One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, of course, money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency and planning keeps your money. Are there ethics? politicians are well known to say, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Well, that's obviously not true. You may work hard, but you may overspend or gamble or have five kids, three of whom are college age, or live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or even have a shopping addiction. So think about this for a moment. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Think outside the box. Think anybody and their work. Who has the best work ethic? When I've done this in groups, I've had, here in Houston, people will guess, well, farmers or, you know, shrimp boat owners. So who do you think has the best work ethic? You ready for the answer? Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, plus holidays, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. One heroin addict summarized it by saying, you know, if I don't get up early in the morning and hustle all day, and the next day after that, I'll die. So I mention that to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, and especially with success ethic. I mean, haven't you heard somebody say, yeah, I got up early, I was at my desk for 10 hours, and, you know, that's a work ethic. That's not a performance or even a success ethic. So why do we make these money errors? In one sense, the more we give money meaning, the more we may lose focus on what money really means. And then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Two of my clients were Madoff victims. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Think about that. I said it fast, so you have to think about it. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just gave up. Gifted people may not convert their talent into sufficient income. Think about how ridiculous it is to share the assumption of starving artists. Why should people who have exceptional talent not make exceptional money? Balanced individuals can sometimes spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise, dependable people ignore financial matters until they're serious. Highly principled individuals may step over boundaries and write their own rules. I'm here in Houston. Remember the Enron story. Others can be taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that may imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. That's part of your job description. Money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands or our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, neurological wirings. And think of how much more abstract, how much more digital it's become. Do you look on CNBC at the markets on a anywhere near a regular basis and see the wild swings? Bitcoin changes up to $4,000 or $5,000 per coin per day. All right, here's a 22-second history of money. First, two goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as a configuration of electrons. 21 seconds, I made it. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades, and our relationship with it changes. Here's a simple example. People spend 23% more when they use a credit card than they do with cash or checks, because it's an abstraction, first of all. It doesn't involve one of the two fundamental motivations we have as human beings to avoid pain, because it's going to be next month. It's an abstraction. I don't have to pay till next month. And the immediate pleasure, mediated by dopamine, of the just the anticipation of spending money gives a hit of dopamine. So everything is wired to spend more money when you use a charge card. Here are some mind matters and brain business with a question. What's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? There's a one-word answer, everything. So think about one aspect of it. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? Why don't people recognize their money story if it's not working? Do something different. If you're not charging enough, if you're having stumble troubles when you quote your professional fees, just do different. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, sometimes do it harder, and expect a different result? That's like if somebody doesn't understand English, you repeat louder, as if that's going to work. Even when it may lead to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or compromised relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. Think about, for example, those of you who do couples coaching. Think about when one partner has money wired, hardwired, as freedom, and the joy then is about spending money. The other partner has money wired as security, so the real pleasure and living into that principle would be saving. So your work is cut out for you to create a common ground, a negotiation, collaboration, and creating a game plan that both people are facilitated to create a new story for themselves. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's a default mode. And we repeat because we know exactly how it's going to turn out. And that creates the illusion of effectiveness, just because we know how it's going to turn out. A new story generates, on the other hand, uncertainty and trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel comfortable or safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, that internal map that's synonymous with identity. That is the most powerful force of the human psyche, our identity. If you help a client engage a change of behavior, unless there's a transformation into the operating model that a client has to incorporate that change, and their identity, that operating model, is the same as it was before, not incorporating that change, they're going to revert back to the way they were before. That's why the P of the roadmap, the last step, is how can we do that to help someone transform their identity? That's what makes change permanent. So, let's do a brief exercise. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers firmly. Notice, with that firm clasp, which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers firmly together. Clasp firmly, but change so that your other thumb is on the top. Feels kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, move your thumbs back to their original place. Kind of a relief. That's why people don't change. That's why people don't succeed remarkably. That's why people derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, either way, such as a major transition really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change and how to involve the brain in this and the error detection mechanism. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Always. Remember that every client, every step, and you'll experience it yourself. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it would snow, he would be the first as a kid to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn despite its circuitous route. They came and went in the same path. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. And he repeated this no matter how many turns and twists. Each person continued to follow their initial path of least resistance. This is how neuronal pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience, a fresh path in the snow when you don't know exactly where you're going. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, or a new context. That's exactly what we do in coaching. So we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this experience is something that we can read as evidence of not to proceed, as intuition of a wrong choice, or as a signpost of change and progress. Here's what we know now. Our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. So how we frame something, and read this as part of your job description as a coach, how we frame something determines how we proceed. If we frame it as anxiety, that may mean danger, better head for cover. It makes sense to stop. If we frame it as excitement, as possibility, as a challenge, then we began to think of new and different ways to proceed. That's what creates new neuronal networks and pathways in the brain. And we'll return to the whole notion of how we frame something because that makes a huge difference in terms of how we proceed. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. And as I mentioned, our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center of the brain. It says this isn't normal when we try something new. And we'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So this means that we each struggle to embrace change. Many, and this is the paradox in a way, many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. So we're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and to guide strategies of change. sometimes we even have to outsmart our brains. We can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create a significantly successful new story. So how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? Because the brain has a mind of its own, and we are of two or more minds. One example, neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRIs, a video of the brain in action as it responds to different situations, like used in the Cabernet study. These studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic. This began to be challenged by the whole discipline of behavioral economics, which shows us how people really make decisions as opposed to how they think they make decisions. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activity. We're going to use these findings to help us understand and inform certain decisions. Here's some examples, just to illuminate. The prefrontal cortex says, let's think about the 12-month game plan and do retirement savings planning. And the limbic brain says, relax, let's have a cognac and order that 32-inch iMac. My amygdala even specifies the brand of cognac, actually single malt, and knows how to pair it with the right cigar. So some of us have developed. Each part of the brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. And emotions do not simply or only corrupt decision-making, but emotions narrow and compress focus on the immediate. The paradox is people who disengage from emotion are not good at decision-making. So we're going to look at how that can come together. Making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to continue, so you want to do more. David Geffen said, anybody who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and smartness, and it could be. But also gamblers interpret good fortune as skill. My wife and I used to play heads-up poker, and she finally confessed to me that she asked me if I wanted for her to tell me one of my tells, so I knew that our poker playing days were close to being over, that she was going to. And she said, well, the biggest one is when you happen to draw a really lucky hand, you have a smug look like you think you're brilliant. I knew she was right, too. Busted. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't work. That's what we do in coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. The components that work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work may need to be revised in order to enhance money and life stories, and to discern what's really about money and what actually hitchhikes on money. The secret here is that most of the stuff is actually hitchhiking on money. But your life can be significantly changed by changing your money story. Money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money is going to exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money will make them more drunk. If somebody's insecure, money's going to make them more paranoid. If somebody's caring and generous, money will help them be a better philanthropist. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances or economics. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including about money. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money aren't about money at all. Money is a portal to the immaterial and the tangible. So, we began a journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, or write an informed, powerful, new money story. We're in discussion mode now, so if you'll manage the background noise, I'm interested in thoughts, questions, clarifications, things you'd like to maybe talk a little bit more about. Anyone?
Hey, Dave. It's PJ.
Hey, PJ. How are you doing? You sent in some great questions. I can't possibly cover all those in four seminars, but go for it. What you got?
Okay. During the lecture, you mentioned a conflict between the subconscious. Is it the subconscious and the shadow? Could you speak more about that conflict and maybe a couple of things we can do to help our clients resolve it?
Okay. Let me ask also for each of you to manage the background noise, to be on mute until you're ready to speak, because your microphone may be picking up things that you're not hearing. So if you would go on mute, I can go back on lecture mode, but I'd rather keep an open mic here. So the practical application here is we never have to go into what's unconscious or the depth of meaning of anything, because everything that's important is going to show right there in the process or in the content of what the exchange is. The client is always going to show us exactly what it's like to be him or her. So could I get a mute, please? I may have bored somebody to go to sleep. I'm not sure if that's snoring, but it's a little distracting. I can go back on lecture mode, but I like to be sure that PJ can interrupt me here because she has a good question. So I'm going to go back on lecture mode, and I'll come back, PJ, and see if this makes sense. So a way to talk about this in coaching is to look at the surface story of what someone is aware of, what their conscious, logical, intellectual goals are. I want to generate money and create wealth is the example I gave. The shadow story may or may not be conscious, but it comes from that operating system that if it opposes that surface story, if it goes in the opposite direction of, well, you know, I think it would be just too risky if I tried my best and then failed, or I think it would be unspiritual to make a bunch of money, or anything that opposes that, when it goes in the opposite direction, it can be an equal and opposite force and somebody's stuck. So it may be helpful to look at what their surface story is, because that's what we're working with in coaching, but then to illuminate what other beliefs or assumptions or biases are about, to illuminate that. And let's say, for example, the two most basic forces of the human psyche are, as I mentioned, the desire to create pleasure and the desire to avoid pain. And when we proceed, we assume it's going to be pleasurable. If we stop ourselves, we assume there's going to be pain. So it may not be fair or useful to say that somebody's sabotaging themselves by stopping themselves short. They may be doing what they may consider adaptive if the source of the pain or the assumption or belief about the pain, like, you know, I'll expose myself and be embarrassed for the rest of my life, that may be simply avoiding what they consider to be embarrassing or painful. So here's a coaching question. At that juncture where there's a conscious surface story and then a shadow story that goes in the opposite direction, whether or not it's conscious, what's the greater pleasure if you do proceed? What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? So that the shadow component of both of those assumptions are examined, and someone can make that conscious and specific and look at what's the next step. we're back in conversation mode. PJ, does that make sense as a probably too simple answer to your question, but at least a beginning?
I think it does, and thank you. I was kind of wondering how you see that and how you help a client get over that conflict, because they are stuck.
Exactly. And it may not be fair to say that they're sabotaging, or they may say that I'm sabotaging myself, but yet if you look together at what their assumption is, what is the frame immediately before they stop themselves? The first question we want to know as a coach is, do they have a plan? And then if they stop themselves and say no to that plan, that's when we can go to work and look at what's the assumption there to you proceeding. If they don't have a plan, that's what we need to do, because that's the system to know what to do next, so that your client, when they hang up the phone or log off the video conference, they know what to do next. It's not just a distant abstract goal, but they have a system, a map of knowing where they are, what the next steps are, because each step will be the experience of effectiveness. And that's the model we hope to convey and collaborate to help someone create a system to proceed, a map, because this is going to be part of your legacy as a mentor coach, that client is going to have a model, a way of working, and a way of proceeding the other 23 hours and 7 days that you're not on the other end of the telephone or the computer, and they've developed a model to proceed, to self-reflect, to evaluate, and to look at things that get in the way, along with some principles of how to do that. So we've begun. I welcome any, and thanks, PJ, for highlighting this. I hope this at least begins to answer your question, which is a good one. And look at the email that I sent around. If you would send any answer to those two questions, either or both of those questions, I promise I will look at them, and it will help guide some of the discussion. And I'm eager to hear what your challenges are in this whole area, and what kind of challenges you primarily see with your clients in this area, because I think this is where we can apply and extend the ideas of developing your expertise and proficiency as mentor coaches. So I look forward to hearing from you. If you have thoughts and are willing to send them to me, we'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much. Have a great rest of the week, and take good care of yourselves. See you guys.
Thanks, Dave.
See you guys.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.